The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here. It's Friday, May the 16th. Today, mistakes will be made if ID cards are introduced. That's according to a panel of expert advisers set up by the government. Conservatives say it's time to scrap the scheme.
At least parts of the government machine want to abandon the whole ID card scheme. And frankly, the sooner they do so, the better.
The Chinese government now says it thinks 50,000 people may have died in the Sichuan earthquake.
Even the People's Liberation Army, which is the biggest army in the world, is simply not up to the task of dealing with a natural disaster on this scale.
Also in today's show, you'll find out what people in Crewe, they're voting in a by-election next week, think of Gordon Brown's tax cuts. And a story of power and passion. Yes, it's Catherine the Great, the musical.
It's got sex, it's got murder, it's even got a horse, if you're that way inclined.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. From guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, let's have today's news headlines and find out what the papers are saying from Sandy War.
President Hu Jintao has arrived in Sichuan province in central China, the scene of Monday's devastating earthquake. Officials now estimate the death toll from the disaster could rise to 50,000. Mr. Hu said the rescue work is at its most crucial phase. More to come on this later in Guardian Daily. Gordon Brown signalled he's ready to compromise on the counter-terrorism bill that would allow suspects to be detained for up to 42 days. The government's concerned the bill may be defeated with the help of Labour rebels. Chief Whip Jeff Hoon has been tasked with striking a deal. The number of people on waiting lists for social housing in Britain could top 5 million within 2 years. Town hall leaders warn today fewer mortgages, increasing numbers of repossessions and a slowdown in house building have all contributed to the demand for council houses. Aid reaching Burma is still far below what's needed, according to the United Nations. The Burmese government's insisted it can cope with the relief operations that have seen up to 2.5 million people in need of assistance. US presidential hopeful Barack Obama has expressed outrage at a speech yesterday by George Bush in which he likened those who want to negotiate with terrorists and extremists to Nazi appeasers. Bush gave the speech to the Israeli parliament. The White House denied the comments were directed at Obama, who's offered to open negotiations with the Iranian leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In cricket, rain interrupted the first day of the Test match at Lord's between England and New Zealand yesterday. James Anderson was the pick of England's bowlers with 3 wickets. New Zealand resumed today on 208 for 6. Now, a look at today's papers. It's a real mixture of front-page leads. The Telegraph goes with its findings that the average cost of a fixed-rate mortgage has hit the highest level since the start of the decade. The Express, meanwhile, says hooray for cheaper home loans, citing a drop in mortgage rates at the Abbey and Nationwide. The Mail calls Barclaycard the cash point card sharks. That's in response to news the company's been encouraging customers to withdraw cash on their credit cards at high rates of interest. Many of the papers today carry pictures of the chaotic scenes from the aftermath of the UEFA Cup final in Manchester on Thursday. Despicable, says the Mirror. A few ruined it for thousands, says the Star. And while the Sun echoes police statements in likening rioting Rangers fans to a pack of wolves. At the end of a week that saw Gordon Brown's attempt to relaunch his premiership, the commentator still needs some convincing. Polly Toynbee in The Guardian says Brown's reputation as a good steward of the economy has taken a beating. Dominic Lawson in The Independent likens the Prime Minister to a robot. Magnus Linklater in The Times, meanwhile, argues that criticism of public figures has lost all proportion. The back pages all focus on Manchester United star Cristiano Ronaldo's refusal to commit his future to the club. Real Madrid could tempt the winger with a huge wage offer. More news and analysis updated through the day at guardian.co.uk.
An independent group of experts appointed by the government to advise it on ID cards warns today that the biometric scheme is bound to make mistakes. People's identities will be mixed up. The Independent Scheme Assurance Panel says in its annual report that the system will never be free of errors. The Shadow Home Office Minister Damian Green told our chief political correspondent Nicholas Watt that the government should abandon its plans for ID cards.
Absolutely. It's yet another nail in this particular coffin affecting the government, because the basis of arguments for an ID card scheme, for a biometric ID card scheme, is that it's foolproof. You can actually solve benefit fraud, terrorism, serious crime, all those things, because once you've established an identity, that's it. Well, what this report, done by a group of independent experts appointed by the Home Office itself, shows us is that there will always be errors, they say, and not just human errors, not just people entering data wrongly, but actually technical errors in the biometric matching between your card and your identity on the National Identity Register and yourself.
And they're basically saying that those mistakes, both by man and machine, will inevitably happen, and that they're actually saying in this report, aren't they, that the government, in drawing up the plan, needs to sort of write those errors into its plan.
That's right. And what's interesting is that the government hasn't made any kind of provision for this and hasn't decided what level of error it will permit, you know, whether 1%, 5%, 10% would be permissible. And if I'm being cynical about this, I'm not surprised the government hasn't addressed that issue, because in addressing that issue, it has to admit that these mistakes will be made, and that therefore, if they're going to rely completely on an ID card system to allow people to establish their identity, then for some people, this will cause untold misery, because there'll be mistakes. Their identity will have disappeared or will have been assigned to someone else.
And this report actually says, delicately, diplomatically, that these errors will have an impact on public opinion.
Well, indeed, and indeed it will. Yeah, the chairman of the panel that produces this report is himself a non-executive director of the Identity and Passport Service, so he is absolutely at the heart of the body tasked with producing this system. If a panel chaired by someone like that says that there will be errors and that these errors will affect public confidence, then we can be very sure that it will. I think this is a devastating report for the future of this scheme.
And there are other issues raised by this report, aren't they? They say that there's poor coordination across government departments, or rather between government departments. They're saying that senior officials don't seem to be talking to each other, and they even say that ministerial group's been wound up.
And I think that last point is the most significant, because it means that all the other parts of government, departments like the benefits agencies, the Department for Work and Pensions, and so on, they are absolutely central to any kind of success of this scheme. And now the ministers from those departments aren't even meeting. There isn't even a ministerial committee. There was one. It's now been abandoned. It does feel to me that at least parts of the government machine want to abandon the whole ID card scheme. And frankly, the sooner they do so, the better.
But the government is obviously saying, we're pressing ahead, foreign nationals will need ID cards, that foreign nationals from outside the EU will need ID cards from next year. National rollout by 2017, we're pushing ahead, they say.
I'm not sure 2017 feels like pushing ahead to me, and every year they make an announcement with the final date pushed back a bit. But I think the point about foreign nationals is interesting, because we have no objections in principle to foreign nationals having biometric passports, biometric visas, but if they're not going to work, if there are going to be errors, then I imagine the foreign governments whose citizens will be affected by this will have something to say. So even on that uncontroversial part of the ID card scheme, this report is extremely interesting, because what level of error is going to be permissible for these biometric visas for foreign nationals?
What do you say to criticism that the world that we live in now is very different to the world that we lived in when you were last in government? Indeed, I think you were working in Downing Street in the last years of John Major's time in office, that we live in a post 9/11 world and that we need these for our own security.
Well, if they made us more secure, then there would be a case for them. But throughout the debate on biometric identity cards, the government has switched the reasons for introducing them. They swivel between benefit fraud, between stopping crime, stopping international terrorism. And at every point, we discover that this is not a magic bullet. This is not the foolproof method.
Damian Green from the Conservatives talking to The Guardian's Nicholas Watt. And there's more on ID cards at guardian.co.uk/ID cards. Also on The Guardian's website today, Rowena Davis on the truth behind the rising statistics of girl crime. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Chris McGreal reports from the Democratic Republic of Congo. After more than a decade of invasion, civil war and slaughter, a second generation of killers is being reared to hate and murder Tutsis. guardian.co.uk/Congo. And Dave Stelfox on the British urban music touted as the next big thing a few years ago. Find out whatever happened to grime at guardian.co.uk/music. China's most powerful earthquake in 30 years is now known to have killed almost 20,000 people, although the Chinese government has now said the death toll could reach 50,000. The Guardian's Jonathan Watts is in the city of Mianyang, the epicentre of the earthquake and site of the biggest refugee camp in Sichuan. He says time is now running out for the people trapped under the rubble.
That's right. The officials in charge of the emergency relief operation are saying that 3 days is the maximum that people can normally be expected to survive without food and water. And so they're calling on the rescue teams to make an extra big push now in the hope that they will be able to pull out a few more survivors. And indeed, there has been some success. There have been amazing pictures on Chinese state television. A young girl peering out from the rubble where she's been for the past 3 days. And eventually getting rescued. But time is definitely not on the side of the people who have not got out so far.
And that the Chinese government have revised the death toll?
They have. It's now expected that 50,000 people may have been killed by this earthquake. That's 10,000 more than previously been predicted.
And they've appealed for the Chinese people to donate equipment to help rescue survivors of the earthquake.
Yes, I think there's a realisation now that even the People's Liberation Army, which is the biggest army in the world, is simply not up to the task of dealing with a natural disaster on this scale. So the government have called on private citizens to donate necessary goods, such as, in terms of small things, mobile phones, and also in terms of very, very important things, heavy lifting equipment. They're asking for 100 cranes, for example, and bulldozers, and these sorts of things that really should have been there more quickly. And if any country should be able to respond to this, it ought to be China, which probably has more cranes and bulldozers than any other on Earth, though, of course, until now, that's generally been for this huge construction boom that we've seen.
And have the people who have survived the earthquake got enough food and drink and essential supplies?
It depends on the area. A lot of people that I've spoken to in affected areas have said that they have enough water, they have enough food, that the emergency, the refugee camps are giving them all that they need. But at the same time, we're getting reports from more remote areas that they may have enough food for a little bit longer, but they're already running out of water. And I think getting water to remote communities will become something of a priority from now on.
And there are increasing fears about some of the dams in the area affected by the earthquake.
Yes, we've had fears about the dams from day one. The giant Three Gorges Dam is said to be safe, but the Minister of Water Resources, Chen Lei, had a speech put on his ministry's website in which he said the damage from the quake is extensive and the hazards are unclear, which has raised fresh alarms about the possibility of a dam collapse. It adds to a sort of a hodgepodge of fears associated with the quake. Among them, there are rumours going around that there are chemical spills. There are also fears that there may be a nuclear leak from, not from a power plant, there are no nuclear power plants in Sichuan province, but there are smaller research facilities, including some very secretive military ones. And I tried to go in one of those today and was denied entry.
Jonathan Watts in the city of Mianyang in Sichuan province. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Lionel Shriver at the Guardian Book Club on her best-selling novel We Need to Talk About Kevin. And Bobby Sands and the IRA hunger strikers are the subject of a new movie by Brit artist Steve McQueen, screened at the Cannes Film Festival.
The Cannes organisers this year have made a great play of saying that they want films that reflect the world that we're living in today. The result of that is that you're getting a lot of fairly harsh, fairly bleak movies.
But first, next Thursday, it's the Crewe and Nantwich by-election caused by the death of the sitting MP, Gwyneth Dunwoody. Her daughter, Tamsin Dunwoody, is defending a 7,000 majority for Labour. If the Tories win it, it'll be the first time they've taken a seat from Labour in a by-election for more than 20 years. The Guardian's Stephen Morris went to Crewe to gauge voters' response to Gordon Brown's £2.7 billion package of tax cuts.
Coronation Street in Crewe. Labour is holding a party in the front garden of a semi-detached house. The star guest is Liz Dawn. She's better known as Vera Duckworth from the fictional Coronation Street, the long-running soap. She's a long-term Labour supporter.
I think it's taken up the balloon. Thank you.
And this is your house where the party is today, Alan?
It is, yes.
You're a Labour supporter, clearly.
I certainly am, yes. Yep.
So how do you think Labour's doing at the moment?
Well, I don't think they're doing very well, but with a lot of support, I think they'll be OK. I think they'll do very well, actually. Because they've always pulled themselves out in the end, haven't they?
What do you think of the developments of the 10p tax rate?
Oh, I don't like it, because I got made redundant after 28 years and I've had to take a basic wage pay in a new job, and it's made me a bit worse off. I have to dip into food money all the time now, even though I've still got to pay full council tax and rent and everything. Petrol's going up, fuel's going up, everything's going up, but I haven't got a wage rise to cover it. So, struggling.
Sandra and Jim Evans, what do you think of the visit today?
I thought it's gone off very well, and Liz Dawn, Vera, as we all know her, was great. She seems down to earth, a very nice lady.
And what about the candidate?
Oh, yes, and Tamsin, yeah. She seems very nice, as if, you know, she's eager to get things done, hopefully, and sorted.
And Labour's having a few problems at the moment. What do you make of that?
It will be sorted out. There's no two ways. Gordon Brown will sort it out. Give the man time.
Steve Morris reporting from Crewe. Catherine the Great ruled Imperial Russia with an iron grip back in the 18th century. Well, now her life story has been made into a musical. It opened last night in Yekaterinburg, the city that takes its name from Catherine. Our Russian correspondent, Luke Harding's in Moscow. He thinks Catherine's life has got the necessary ingredients of a successful musical.
Well, I think it's got everything, John. It's got sex, it's got murder, it's even got a horse, if you're that way inclined. I mean, really, there's very little it hasn't got. I mean, it's a great story. I mean, you know, Catherine the Great was the sort of classic, sort of pushy, you know, German princess. In fact, she was actually called Sophie originally, who was supposed to be meekly married off to the future Tsar of Russia, and arrived in St. Petersburg, learnt Russian very quickly, bumped off her husband, and became empress herself, and then kind of initiated this rather despotic but also at the same time enlightened dynasty in which she had lots and lots of lovers, a whole string of young men, really, you know, from court, and then died improbably in, you know, after 34 years on the throne in 1762 while climbing onto a horse. So there's very little the story doesn't have.
Is the music, as a Western audience would recognise to be a kind of, you know, does it follow the sort of musical tropes that a West End musical or a Broadway musical might follow, or is it more traditionally Russian?
No, it's more like Les Miserables or Chicago or something like that. I mean, it's got rock, it's got some, you know, more kind of classical operatic bits, and it's also got some Russian Orthodox music, as you would expect in keeping with the character of Catherine the Great. But basically, it's a jolly, modern and progressive sort of romp. I mean, the one thing I would say is that unlike in London musicals, the actors and actresses actually keep their clothes on. They don't strip off. This is in keeping with Russia's slightly more conservative sensitivities. Although the director has said that if he takes the musical to Germany, where people have trouble keeping their clothes on, that he'll kind of add a bit more explicitness. But it's all there, the lovers, the power, the despotism, all done on stage.
Catherine the Great was one of many autocratic rulers in Russian history. How is she regarded today?
If you talk to Russians about their you know, country and the way it's governed, that they sort of say that, you know, Russia's always had a kind of firm leader from, you know, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, through to Vladimir Putin. She's obviously a colossal figure here, but I have to say, not one that one would expect to be sort of treated in this way, someone you would expect to find in history books rather than cavorting on stage in front of you.
Will audiences outside Russia get to see Catherine the Great, the musical?
Well, I know that the composer who's been working on this for almost a decade, Sergei Brezhnev, is keen to take Catherine the Great on a kind of European tour. And actually, I mean, it's sufficiently wacky and sufficiently fun. I mean, it's being premiered at the moment in the Theatre of Musical Comedy in Yekaterinburg. That it's also got a big budget of about £400,000, which is large by Russian standards, that I think it's got every chance of breaking through outside Russia.
Luke Harding.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Hunger, the first feature film by the Turner Prize-winning British artist Steve McQueen, has been screened at the Cannes Film Festival. It concerns life in the Mays prison at the time of the IRA hunger strike, led by Bobby Sands. Zan Brooks is in Cannes. So, Zan, hunger, a controversial subject.
I don't know how controversial it is now. I think it's the sort of film that, had this come out 10 years ago, it would have been guaranteed to have the tabloids kind of up in arms. Perhaps the Northern Ireland issue is slightly less charged these days. But it's still a grueling and provocative film from the artist Steve McQueen about the Mays prison protests of the early 80s, focusing obviously on Bobby Sands, the sort of the first man over the parapet in a way, in terms of the hunger strike. It's, I guess you could say it's a kind of typical artist's take on this sort of charged material, in that it's very sort of intense, it's slow burning, it's sort of poetic in a lot of ways. But it has a real kind of grueling quality to it, and a lot of grit there too. So, I mean, you know, this isn't up for the Palme d'Or. This is up for the certain regard section, and it stands a chance of winning.
As you say, not Steve McQueen's first film, but it was his first script. And will Hunger, will it have any appeal to mainstream audiences?
I sort of suspect not. I think if you're interested in the Troubles, obviously you're gonna beat a path to see this film. But otherwise, it will probably cater to a slightly art house audience. Steve McQueen wrote the script alongside the playwright Ender Walsh, who wrote Disco Pigs, he's sort of best known for. And it's a kind of decent, solid script, but the actual kind of visuals are great of the film. And it's got a fantastic transformation from the actor playing Bobby Sands, who does a sort of almost reverse De Niro in Raging Bull, in just sort of shedding the pounds and looking absolutely emaciated by the end of the film. It's not an easy watch. It's tough going, but it's definitely worth checking out.
And Hunger is not the only film concerning the IRA that's been causing a stir.
That's right. There's this film called 50 Dead Men Walking, which apparently was going to be playing here at Cannes, but has been yanked. Whether it's been yanked because of this sort of, you know, blooming legal cloud surrounding it remains slightly to be established. Basically, this is a film about an IRA informant, Martin McGartland, who's depicted in the film. And the real Martin McGartland is still around, still living in hiding, and is threatening legal action because he says that the film gets kind of a couple of things very wrong. Most notably, his beef with the film is that it sort of implies that he was a disgruntled IRA man who kind of switched sides, whereas he says that he was actually a special branch agent who infiltrated the IRA specifically to inform against them, which seems like a fairly big major issue, if that's correct. So, yeah, he's threatening legal action about this film. This film stars Ben Kingsley. The body behind it, Northern Ireland Screen, is saying it's still in post-production. They never had any intention of showing it at Cannes anyway. But, yeah, this one will sort of run and run, I guess.
And Cannes does seem to be hosting quite a few films this year, based on terrifying and horrible events in recent history. Another that you've seen, Zan, is the Israeli animation Walk with Bashir.
This is my highlight of the festival so far, I think. The Cannes organisers this year have made a great play of saying that they want films that reflect the world that we're living in today. The result of that is that you're getting a lot of fairly harsh, fairly bleak movies. And Waltz with Bashir is animator Ari Folman, who used to serve in the Israeli army at the time of the 1982 massacre of Palestinian civilians by the Christian militia in Lebanon. This is his kind of personal investigation into that atrocity.
Zan Brooks in Cannes. Lionel Shriver's novel, We Need to Talk About Kevin, was celebrated by critics and a hit with the public when it was published in 2003. Sold more than a million copies and won Shriver the Orange Prize. The fictional account of a high school massacre touched a nerve with readers, and it sparked many discussions of motherhood and parental responsibility. Well, one such debate took place this week at the Guardian Book Club, where Lionel Shriver appeared with The Guardian's John Mullen. Here's the author explaining why she chose a crossbow as the murder weapon.
I thought it made a lot of sense for Kevin to try to deprive his mother, as well as the rest of the world, of the one real lesson that you can generally take from these incidents, right? Tighter gun control. He wanted his atrocity to be an act of perfect nihilism. And therefore, if you take the gun control thing out of the argument, then you deprive them of you deprive the incident of meaning, of any obvious meaning. But the other purpose it served was authorial. I didn't want my book to just be an argument for gun control, right? So if I as author took that out, then you can't simplify it to that. It becomes much more Greek, right? And it's more about malice, pure malice, and it's not about the instrument of malice. And after all, it's still a big subject. Look at Rwanda. They didn't have guns either. They didn't even have crossbows. And they killed almost a million people. So with machetes. So I didn't think that it meant that that it would make the book politically irrelevant, but it would make the book less politically simple.
Lionel Shriver. And you can hear the full discussion from the Guardian Book Club about We Need to Talk About Kevin at guardian.co.uk/books. Guardian Daily Today was produced by Phil Maynard. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.